Hello, I'm Rhonda McBride. Happy to be here with you today to bring you what I hope will be a great big Friday exhale. Coming up on Juno Afternoon, the adventures of Uliana Horodesk. Talk about seeing life at the 13,000 foot level. Our guest today says that we can learn a lot about climate change by studying mountain glaciers. Roy Watt also gives us the big picture view for the city and borough of Juneau as it climbs out of the pandemic. And homeschooling in Juneau, COVID caused enrollment to mushroom, how families continue to gravitate towards the Homebridge program. Some of the conversations coming your way on this Friday's Juneau Afternoon. Well, we've got to plow through a few more weather fronts until we get to a period of cooler and drier air, which should arrive early next week. But for tonight through Saturday night and maybe into Sunday afternoon, you can expect rain in the forecast. Lows in the upper 30s for tonight with winds out of the east, 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow, the snow level will be at 1,000 feet. Highs in the lower 40s with southeast winds around 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, rain for Juneau and Douglas. Elsewhere, that rain could turn to snow. Cooler than tonight with lows in the lower 30s, south winds around 10 miles per hour. Now, Sunday is now where we seem to see a shift in our wet weather with mostly cloudy skies, snow showers in the morning, a chance of rain in the afternoon as well. But after that, colder temperatures will put a brake on the rain for the next week. And there's a chance of snow almost every day through Thursday, highs in the upper 20s, lows to the lower to mid 20s. So that sounds like the sweet spot for outdoor recreation. Sun rises tomorrow morning at 8:05, sets at 4:16 in the afternoon. We are now up to 8 hours and almost 11 minutes of daylight.
Support for Juneau Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juneau with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juneau. More at heritagecoffee.com.
KTOO would like to acknowledge that we broadcast from the homelands of the Akwan. The Tlinédi have stewarded this area for thousands of years. Today, our studios sit on what were once tide lands, now covered over with buildings, roads, and parking lots. We recognize those families who traveled to and from their homes from these tide lands to fishing and hunting grounds and to gatherings in other villages and still cherish it as an important part of their way of life for today and the future.
Hands and grass, ka eat with the shu yi, we kashuk a yi tin. Jin kat ka ke jin ta khanakhaya ha anikak gunil chish.
Gunashchish for being here with us today. You are listening to Juneau Afternoon. I'm Rhonda McBride. Well, you've got to hand it to the Fireside Lecture Series because last week they took you to the deep waters of Southeast Alaska, and this week they're going to take you to the mountaintops of the Andes, the Alps, and the Himalayas all over the world to explore climate change and much more. And your guide to this adventure will be Uliana Horodesky, and she is here with us now to give us a preview of tonight's presentation. Actually, she came all the way to Juneau to give this presentation at Mendenhall Glacier in person, but due to the high COVID rates, once again, the lecture has been moved online at a virtual presentation at 7 o'clock tonight. But Uliana, welcome to Juneau, and I bet you're really glad that you're actually here in a way, even though you don't get to give your lecture in person.
Thanks so much. It's really nice to be here. I'm a glaciologist, right? And so having the opportunity to be here in Alaska, to be able to see the Mendenhall Glacier, it's just such a privilege. And thanks very much for hosting me today.
Well, we're excited to hear a little bit about your lecture tonight. But first, can we find out a little bit about you? Currently, you're based out of Colorado. And what are you doing there?
Yeah, so I'm near Denver, Colorado, and I work at the University of Colorado in Boulder. They have a center called the North Central, a Climate Adaptation Science Center. And so I work as an associate scientist there, as well as a communication specialist. My PhD was in glaciology and geology, but I've branched towards climate change just because glaciers are definitely related to that. And I really love educating the public on science. So it kind of led to this career path that has me doing that now, communicating with the public.
And that's so important because so much of science can appear to be sort of gray and challenging to take in and to embrace. And it takes a special storytelling talent to be able to bring that to life, I imagine.
Yeah, absolutely. Like what I like to say is that it's the art of science storytelling, right? The data are really hard sometimes for people to really grasp. What is it showing? What are these graphs? How do we actually interpret or translate this? And that's kind of where I come in and saying, like, what's the relevance of this? How does it relate to our everyday lives? Why should we care about polar bears, for example, or penguins for that matter? But this world is interconnected. And so through my lecture, I hope to show just how interconnected we are as a species and as a planet.
So I'm curious about glaciers. You've visited glaciers all over the world. Maybe you could rattle off a few that you've been to, but what is the advantage of seeing a whole bunch of glaciers?
Yeah, it's basically like the more books you read, the more you learn. So you can think about these glaciers as being books. They're telling us more about the history of a particular region. And so the more you read, the more you learn about different areas, but then you see how they connect also. And so some of the places I've worked in include up in the north, place called Baffin Island in the Canadian Arctic, the one of the biggest ice caps that's left as a result of the last ice age, down in Antarctica in the peninsula region, which is one of the fastest warming places on the planet, the Himalaya, also known as the third pole, just because it has so much ice there that millions of people rely upon. And think of these glaciers as water storage towers. You know, once those run out, we're going to be in trouble. And you can also see them as time capsules. You know, there's a history there that's been recorded and it's melting away. So we need to be able to gather that information before it's gone.
But cross-referencing all these different glaciers, how does that help? Just to see how one glacier is doing over here in this part of the world and over there in another.
Yeah, so when you think about the north and the southern hemispheres, they are impacted differently. We have the Arctic, which is an ocean surrounded by land, and Antarctica, which is land surrounded by ocean. So the way those glaciers behave is different, yet at the same time, they're all revealing a story of climate change. So the more you can learn about the different responses, you also try to find a commonality there. And that commonality is that where the glaciers are in retreat, they're melting, and they're telling us that things aren't right on the planet. They're not in balance.
Well, I have to ask, your most recent trip took you to the Andes. And for many people who don't know about it, there was a tremendous plane crash there 50 years ago in which there were, 45 people on board, 16 survived after two harrowing months. And of course, I guess people know this story because there was some cannibalism involved for the 16 people to make it out of the glacier. But they were stranded for 2 months before they found help. So it's quite a story. So you were up there at the crash site. What were you looking for and how much had it changed?
Yeah, so the backstory of that is my husband, Ricardo, is a mountaineer. He's fascinated by the story. And back in 2005, he actually went to the site and climbed up a gully where the impact point presumably was. And he found a bunch more of the plane parts up there, as well as something buried in the rocks. And it was a coat. And when he opened up the coat, there was actually still a passport and a wallet in there. And it was actually from one of the survivors. So he reached out to the survivor and it started this long friendship now where they go every year and take people actually to the site because it's just such a story of perseverance and resilience. It's just an incredibly moving story. And so we were just there for the 50th anniversary, and it's stunning. The last time we were there was 2020, right before the pandemic hit. And just seeing in 2 years how much the glacier has melted. I mean, there's artifacts melting out of the glacier that were there for 50 years, you know, covered up. And now it's just, it's a place that's quite remote. It takes 4x4 vehicles, it takes horseback and then on foot to get there. And it's right on the border with Chile. And so most people wouldn't go there if it wasn't for the story and what happened there. So these glaciers aren't being studied. So it's also an opportunity to document, you know, what is changing in one of these remote places, meaning that climate change touches every part of the planet, not just the ones that are nearby urban, you know, cities.
That is an amazing story. Just being there on scene, seeing the debris from the wreckage and the clothing, things like that. What went through your mind?
It really brings the story to life. You know, you read a story, you read Alive, that's the name of the book, and I've seen the movie. And I was sitting on the spot where the fuselage, the part of the plane, came to rest, where the survivors lived out the 72 days. And I was reading pages of the book right there on the same spot. And I was looking out east, what they were seeing. And I was looking west and thinking, how in the world do we climb this peak? And it was just an absolutely surreal experience to be like, how did they manage to really survive all this? What it took mentally and physically. And then just seeing the evidence melting out of the glacier, you know, there's seats, tray tables, armrests, and to think someone was sitting in that. You know, it's such a tragedy, but also a story of resilience.
Well, I suppose that we're going to be seeing more things emerge out of long frozen glaciers from the past in coming years. And some of it might be very interesting to discover, Neanderthal bones, old artifacts that might give us more understanding of the past. But absolutely, in a way, it is sort of unnerving to think that things are emerging this quickly.
Right. That's the thing. Like we knew this was going to happen, but we're thinking about it decades down the road, right? To see something like this happening again, like just in 2 years' time, seeing these big cracks, the crevasses opening up in a glacier and meltwater channels and waterfalls forming from all the melting ice was just stunning. And it really highlights that we are running out of time, you know, to do something about it. Yet it's not a hopeless situation. There's a lot we can and should be doing.
So one of the things in your research is you've documented how something that happens weather-wise or disaster-wise in one part of the world affects another part of the world way, way, way far away.
Yeah, so when you think about just the winds, for example, winds can carry stuff a long way. So thinking about, for example, a forest fire, right? A forest fire somewhere in Western Canada or even here in Alaska, the winds can carry that soot, you know, that residue from that wildfire all the way over to parts of Europe and Asia, right? Because it's in a matter of just a couple of weeks. And then when that soot settles out on that snow and ice up there, in fact, that those dark particles can absorb more of the sun's energy and melt that snow faster. So it's not just a problem with rising temperatures. It's also this pollution problem. Now, wildfires aren't pollution coming from people, right? But wildfires are a result of things drying up and drought and causing more fires than otherwise would be happening.
So you found evidence of this in Norway, right? Of an American forest fire impacting glacial melting all the way in Norway.
Yeah. So, and how you can do that is knowing you can use these computer models that tell you where the winds came from. So first the direction, and then look at the timing of when you were there. And just even collecting samples of snow and ice from the surface can reveal it, or you dig down a little bit deeper and you can find it. And not only that, but now they're even finding microplastics way up north. So that's, again, evidence of us having an impact that's reaching much further than we expected.
So one of the things that you do is you combine science and mountaineering. That is an interesting combination. How does it help your research?
Yeah, so I was always restless as a kid. You know, I was always doing sports camps and I was playing soccer and running track, but I loved science too. And I was kind of torn because as a kid, I'm like, I want to do science fairs, but I want to be on a sports team, but that doesn't really mesh well. You don't have enough time to do it. And so as I grew older and went to college and thinking about career-wise, what I want to do, I'm like, maybe there's a way I can blend these things, and maybe I can go and collect samples and scientific observations where people who don't have the scientific training but who climb won't know to do. So that kind of got me thinking about, well, maybe I should train more seriously as a mountaineer, really learn the skills to be able to do science in those far corners of the planet, and then the high, I like to call it high latitudes and high altitudes.
Well, one of the things that you have done here in Alaska, which is kind of exciting, and we just had a segment on this on Juno Afternoon not too long ago, is the Inspiring Girls Expeditions, because they're trying to recruit more girls. And you led an expedition for the Girls on Ice group. And what was that all about? And what did you share with the girls?
Yeah, so that was a great opportunity. So I was able to do this in Mount Baker in Washington State, as well as the Golconda Glacier in Alaska. And that was actually my first time to Alaska back in 2015. And it was a great way to get young girls who may be interested but intimidated, you know, by science or by mountaineering. And then throwing them into the wild and doing both at the same time was such a challenge for them. But watching them over the course of that week, like learn about what it takes to actually do science in the wild, and have them also blossom and learn about how they can actually overcome a lot of challenges. I mean, you can imagine bad weather that we had, or rain coming down, hail, everything that they faced, and carrying heavy packs. It was just a really cool thing to be a part of, because, you know, thinking about how I got my start, you know, I was very fortunate. I had parents who really wanted me to do a lot of experiential learning, going on field trips, going out into summer camps. And the beautiful thing about the Inspiring Girls Expeditions is that they fund it. And so girls who might not have a chance to be able to fund something like this get the opportunity to experience it.
Well, I have to ask you this, because for things like mountaineering and the expeditions that you've been on, and the Himalayas, the Alps, Kilimanjaro, I mean, these aren't easy places to get to. They're very physically demanding. Do you feel that women might face a little bit of discrimination because men might be viewed as stronger and more able to weather the conditions?
That's certainly been the case in the past. And I can tell you a story from when I was a kid competing in a science fair at 14 years old. And I was waiting to hear the results of the contest in the back with all these guys who are like 17 and 18 years old. And here I am. It's like, everyone's really tall. And then there's this short little girl. And somebody comes up to me. I was like, are you lost? And I ended up winning my category. So there's definitely this expectation that you don't belong. And in mountaineering, something similar, right? Like, how can you carry heavy packs? How can you do this? But I think that's definitely changing over the years that I've seen. I'm happy to say that. But definitely, I feel like you have to work twice as hard to get half the recognition.
Boy, twice as hard to get half the recognition. But boy, I tell you, I think people will be impressed when they see your presentation tonight. And unfortunately, it has been moved online, but you can go to the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center's Facebook page. It's live. It starts at 7. People can ask you questions. So it's not totally like watching a video or something. It sounds like it'll be fun, and you'll probably have lots of great pictures, right?
Yeah, lots of great pictures. Looking forward to the questions. We want to make it very interactive. One thing I wanted to say is a big thank you to the U.S. Forest Service for setting that up, and Eagle Raven Global as well, a local company here, for sponsoring my visit out here.
Well, I hope that your excursions out to our glaciers make you want to come back here, and we have another chance to talk with you more. Thank you so much. Uliana Horodisky, a good Ukrainian name, right?
Yes, you got it perfect. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much for being here with us today.
Thank you.
You are listening to Juno Afternoon. Good to have you here with us today. I'm Rhonda McBride. It is a good thing Rory Watt, the manager for the City and Borough of Juno, enjoys problem solving, because even in the best of times, problems and challenges can be moving targets. None more so than during a pandemic. I recently talked with Roy Watt and started off our conversation by asking him what his New Year's resolution was last January.
Going into 2021, it would have been to be a little more stable, a little less focused on COVID, a little more focused on community projects and advancing the community and getting back to the way we were in 2019. That would have been my hope.
Well, COVID in 2021 had a kind of a curious arc. It looked like we were headed towards better times, and then it sharply spiked. And we have since been on what I call a COVID coaster. I'm just curious, during the second year of the pandemic, how much got pushed back? How much city business wound up on the back burner because of the constant need to address this?
I think everything slowed down a little bit. And with COVID, there's so much uncertainty and multitasking, and we asked people to assume different roles. And so they were unable to spend much time on their core duties. And I don't think we made as much progress as we would have liked to, but we still keep advancing the ball. And I think we were able to do lots of things, and we should be happy about that.
Well, from a financial standpoint, COVID continued for the second year in a row to hit city finances, though not as bad as in the first year when you had no cruise ship traffic at all. Then this past year, we had sort of a late season. But overall, the dollars and cents still put the city way behind what it normally is.
Certainly, we fell behind in sales tax collection, you know, but we did collect more than we predicted. So that we predicted the news to be bad, but the actual news was a little bit better than we predicted. So it wasn't as bad. We also got a lot of assistance from the state and federal governments in terms of financial aid. And so in the end, I think we actually ended up okay financial-wise. The biggest hit really continues to be on the businesses and where they're going to be moving forward. I don't anticipate federal aid going forward, even if COVID continues on.
So how did you fill the gaps last year in the budget? Primarily with federal grants?
Yeah. So we had several different kinds of grant funds that came through the federal government. It's really kind of a constantly moving target. People kind of think of the budget as one point in time, but really we adopt the budget and then we keep working on it because the information just keeps changing.
It sounds like there were a few silver linings in last year's clouds.
Yeah, I would say federal grants was the biggest, but then we also over-collected revenues compared to what we predicted. So property tax actually came in a lot stronger. Houses really sold this year for high prices. So we've got increased property taxes, which is about half our budget. And our sales tax came in stronger than we predicted, even though we predicted to under-collect. The amount of federal money that came in was really quite massive, whether it came in directly to CBJ or directly to businesses or entities in the community like Search and Central Council. A lot of federal money came into Juneau and Alaska.
Normally, what the city generates, about $10 million in sales tax from visitors?
Probably something like that. So like in a normal year, our 5% sales tax gets us around $50 million. In cruise ship passengers. I think we predict around 20%. It's really actually hard to figure out where the sales tax comes from, you know, because it's all of these individual buying decisions. But, you know, this summer we had a lot of independent travelers. People just got on airplanes and showed up. So even on days that there weren't cruise ships, we did actually see quite a interesting visitation. And one of the things that came in stronger was hotel bed tax. Independent travelers did come and book hotel rooms.
So you saw different pots of money grow and others decrease. But normally in a year, how much do you take in sales taxes?
In a year, it's about $50 million, $53, $55
million. How about passenger fees? Do you know the numbers on that?
So we had this summer a little over 100,000 cruise ship passengers. If you'd asked me 2 years ago, we would have been predicting 1.3 million. We collect local passenger fees and get remittances from the state. So on our local fees of $8, instead of, you know, around 8 or 10 million, we maybe collected around a million. So we were low on passenger fees at the local level. But we also didn't spend money. We also didn't provide a lot of services that we normally provide, things like crossing guards and visitor information, extra bathroom cleaning and whatnot. So we down on revenue, but down in expenditure as well. The legislature did appropriate replacement state passenger fees for 2 years. So we did receive 12 million of those state passenger fees. And so we're using those state fees to advance some projects.
So I guess it's hard to figure out exactly where you are because money is coming from different places and going away in other places, and somehow you have to make it all work out. So this year, if you were to come up with a New Year's resolution for the city, what would it be?
I think my New Year's resolution for this year is to figure out how to finally get back to 2019. It'd be a lot like last year's New Year's resolution. I think figuring out how to move from pandemic to endemic, I think would be high on the list, and how to advance community goals. You know, we've got a lot of things in front of the assembly right now, kind of strategic moves. The assembly's considering, you know, whether we should move on the new city hall project. We've been doing public information on that. They're also looking at the Capital Civic Center project. We've hired the new tourism manager to work on tourism growth issues. So we have a lot of issues that I would like us to be working on. I think the assembly would like that as well.
Well, COVID has been such a strange thing because it seems to go away and then it comes back with a vengeance. And of course, we've got the new Omicron variant. And I saw that the CDC recently warned people away from cruise ships because even though people were vaccinated, they were still having a lot of outbreaks of Omicron on cruise ships. So it seems like we head into 2022 with a lot of uncertainty as to where this pandemic is going to go.
Yeah, I think that's fair. So in 2021, while we and lots of communities across the country were seeing COVID numbers rise from the Delta variant, the cruise ships didn't have that problem. I mean, the cruise ships put in mandatory vaccination for virtually all of their passengers and crew, and they were able to control and contain any situations that arose. In 2022, with Omicron being much more contagious, I agree, it's a little bit more of a wild card. But at the end of the day, I think the cruise ship companies have the ability to maybe be a little sterner in their enforcement of what they're doing. I mean, they can dictate to their employees things like vaccine mandates and not face pushback from the public. Or they can tell their passengers, if you're not vaccinated, you're just not going to come. And I think as we all learn more about Omicron, I think a lot more information will be unfolding. I mean, certainly we're watching on the national news, the CDC guidance on Omicron, and everybody's trying to figure out, is it less virulent? And maybe it's actually going to be helpful. I think we just don't know. But with regard to next year's cruise ship season, you know, if you'd asked me 2 months ago or 6 weeks ago, I would have been very bullish on cruise ship passenger visitation next summer. And I can't claim that same stance today.
So you have had an interesting period these last 2 years. You have 1 year with no cruise ship traffic, and then you have 2021, which had some cruise ship traffic. So you got to see some interesting comparisons. What did you learn besides the fact that cruise ships and their passengers bring in a lot of money? But were there some interesting ways to look at our cruise ship picture by looking at those 2 years?
Well, one of the things that I think I don't fully understand is what's happening with our population and demographics. One of the things that I worry about is that we might be losing younger people. So I think natural for people to migrate out of the town that they grew up in. And I think over the years, we've replaced that because a lot of people, young people, look at Juneau and think, oh, that looks like a really fun place. Maybe I'll go there for the summer. And it's been really relatively easy to get summer employment in tourism. And I think during COVID, you know, we continued to have that out-migration of younger people, but we didn't have the in-migration of new younger workers. So that's an open question for me, what our population looks like moving forward. I think with regard to you know, the forever discussion about the pros and cons of cruise ship tourism, there are lots of arguments that people can genuinely make. you know, our town, our downtown and our business sector really has built itself around a heavy summer season. And if we don't have a heavy summer season, we're going to have different businesses moving forward. So I think that the long-term effects of people not starting new businesses for a couple years, I think, is probably pretty significant. So that's another interesting thing. And while on a really nice, warm, sunny day in June, you could have a quiet walk down the waterfront, it might be nice on that day, but that's not really sustainable. We built the waterfront with fees from cruise ship passengers, and we wouldn't have it. We won't be able to maintain it if we don't keep having cruise ship passengers. So I think there's a lot in there, a lot of interesting ways to look at the situation.
Well, it seems that the people that oppose the growing cruise ship traffic were kind of inspired by the year off to mount a campaign to ban cruise ships. And that petition drive didn't go anywhere, but people still felt that the city and borough did not follow through on looking at ways to make increased cruise ship traffic more manageable. And granted, when you don't have any cruise ship traffic for the moment, it makes more sense to put that issue on the back burner. But eventually it's going to come back. How to make things better for the people who don't like to see that traffic, but also balance it.
So we, prior to COVID, we had the Visitor Industry Task Force, a group of citizens meeting to advise the assembly on issues about tourism management. One of the things that they recommended was that we poll the public, and we did that this fall. And when we polled the public, you know, we generally found from the randomized survey that Juneau felt that the benefits were greater than the problems, fairly significantly, depending on how you wanted to slice and dice the information. The online poll was not the same. The online poll, which you could opt in and just give your opinion, raised more concerns. So more harm than good, maybe, is the summary of the online poll. Interestingly, both groups agreed that the city should do more to manage tourism. So that was kind of interesting. And I think
so they did have a common denominator.
The common denominator. Everybody thinks the city should do more. Then that's fine. I mean, maybe they could take that as a expression of confidence that maybe we can do more. We did recently hire the tourism manager, Alex Pierce, and so she just started. I'm very excited to have Alex on board, and that was also a recommendation from the Visitor Task Force. And the Visitor Task Force really recommended that we figure out how to achieve community goals through negotiation with the cruise ship industry, as opposed to trying to pass regulations. I think that was prudent advice. So I think you're going to see a lot more effort by CBJ to negotiate with cruise ship industry to meet some of those community goals. And there are a lot.
How do you see this new position working? What do you hope that person accomplishes?
I think it's going to evolve, and I think it will grow. So the number one feature of having a tourism manager is the recommendation from the Visitor Task Force was a centralized tourism function. We don't have that right now. So if somebody wanted to talk to somebody at the city about a tourism issue, you might call Docks and Harbors, you might call Parks and Recreation, you might call the manager's office, you might call community development. You know, if it was a capital project, you might call the engineering department. We have a very dispersed way that we deal with tourism issues. And I think that's been a problem. So I think the recommendation of centralizing that makes a lot of sense. So the tourism manager reports to the city manager. So, you know, not stuck between city departments. And I think over time, we're going to evolve the role of the tourism manager. We're just going to have to see what makes sense and how that works. I think the assembly is also going to have to spend a lot more time on tourism than it has in past years. It's going to take that sustained effort by the assembly to be involved and pay attention to tourism.
Well, there is so much going on right now, or potentially about to happen in the city of Juneau. And maybe one of the things we could talk about is some of the work that the Native organizations are doing. We have Sea Alaska Heritage Institute about to open a plaza, an arts school. Rosita Worrell, who's president of SHI, says that she wants to make Juneau the capital for Indigenous arts, not just for the state, but for the whole Pacific Northwest coast. And you also have Tlingit and Haida Central Council that just bought a great big office building. So they've expanded their footprint. So it almost seems like the lower part of downtown Juneau has more and more of a sort of a native face to it.
Yeah, so Dr. Worrell is a true force of nature. She really is impressive in her vision and her follow through. So first with the Dr. Soboloff Center, you know, really magnificent building on Seward Street, and now across the street under construction, the Arts Campus. I mean, that's really, really spectacular. The vision of Juneau being the Pacific Northwest Coast Arts capital of the world, a country or whatever, I think is super special. And the recent announcement by SHI receiving foundation grant money for totem poles on the waterfront is really, really exciting. So I've always enjoyed working with Dr. Worrell and her staff. And I think that's going to make for our waterfront to become even more special and unique. So it's very, very exciting. President Peterson over at Central Council, he's been growing that organization, you know, acquired some really interesting real estate. It's got a lot of employees to house, and I think that will make some more vibrancy in that part of downtown as well. So some really dynamic stuff happening during these COVID years.
Now, you've also talked about moving the Juneau Douglas City Museum over to the waterfront. That's an interesting idea. How viable do you think that is? And where would it go?
Well, it's an idea that I pitched, and it seemed like a decent idea. And I pitched it right before the start of COVID. Maybe we should move the museum to the waterfront and capitalize on cruise ship foot traffic so that it doesn't cost us operational funding and give the existing facility to the legislature. So I think it's still in the good idea phase, or maybe a good idea, depending on who you talk to. I think some people liked the idea, some people didn't. We haven't advanced that idea very much. But I think big picture, interesting ideas like that are, you know, it's good that we keep trying to find ways to move the community forward. So I think that old idea will come back up.
So that's one of those big vision ideas that you have had. What about the project that's right in front of you to build a new city hall? Ultimately, how much money do you think that would save the city to consolidate everybody into one building, or at least in not as many buildings?
Right now, we've got employees in, I think, at least three or four lease spaces downtown, and then we own City Hall. And what people don't really realize is we pay something like $750,000 a year in rent, and we have been doing that my entire municipal career, and I've worked for the city for 28 years. And if instead of paying $750,000 in rent a year, we had just gone and built ourselves a city hall 30 years ago, we would own it. We wouldn't be paying that $750,000 a year in rent every year. The existing city hall, which we own, you know, started its life back in the 50s, and part of it was the fire station. The assembly chambers were the equipment base. That's where the fire trucks parked, in the assembly chambers. And so it's an old building and it needs work. There is no do nothing option. We either need to renovate the existing city hall, and we've got old roof, we've got old plumbing that's failing on us, we've probably got asbestos insulation and mastic in there, we've got rotten windows, we need to paint the building. It's pretty dog-eared. So we're sort of at the point in time where we either need to invest quite a bit of money in the existing building, or we need to pivot to a new idea. I like the new idea of a new city hall for several reasons. One, we would get rid of that $750,000 of rent a year. And two, we would vacate space downtown, which would become housing. And that's one of our downtown goals, is to create more housing downtown. You know, depending on what we do, there have been ideas that maybe we should buy and renovate a building. President Peterson beat us to a really good option by buying the former DNR building. So, you know, he's a little lighter on his feet than we are. You know, there are other ideas like expanding on the Main Street parking garage, or maybe in the location of the former public safety building over next to the State Museum. We're going to be working that throughout this year. I think it's a good move if we get modern, efficient office space. Right now, we're kind of sprawled everywhere, and You know, anybody who's ever been into my office, you know, they could look at it and be like, wow, you have a really big office with, like, I think it's a seven-sided office. It's a very funny shape. It's not very efficient. I think if we can work that process, that could be a very good strategic long-term move for the city that would save us money in the long run and create more housing downtown.
Despite COVID, the work continues, or maybe in spite of COVID.
Yeah, in spite of, I mean, even though COVID has been with us the last couple of years, you know, we continue to do all of the municipal things that we've always done. I mean, we continue to provide drinking water and deal with wastewater, and we build and maintain roads and we plow roads. I know people want us to plow those roads a little bit more right now. This is pretty unusual circumstances. Our police department is out there every day. Our fire department and their EMTs are out there every day. Our parks and recreation functions are out there. All our branches of the public works department, you know, we just have to keep on functioning as a city. Our libraries are open, our museum is open. I mean, all that whole host of city activities, we just keep plugging away. And generally the public is really, really supportive of our municipal services.
I heard that you are a rock climber in your spare time. if you have any spare time.
Yeah, not enough.
What are the life lessons of rock climbing that you apply to your job as city manager?
Well, rock climbing is a lot about problem solving. You have to be willing to accept some risk if you're going to rock climb. And if you can be methodical and focused, very, very enjoyable. I've certainly had a lot of fun this past year rock climbing, although I did fall and break my ankle in August, but I rebounded and I was lucky enough to do some rock climbing over the holidays in Southern California, Joshua Tree National Park. But it provides me a good balance for my work life.
So in other words, you have to learn to manage risk, and that seems to be the challenge of 2022, managing risk.
Fair enough. You know, I don't think we live in a no-risk environment. That doesn't exist. If we tried to have no risk in life, we would have corresponding little enjoyment. I think you have to take some risks.
Rory Watt, manager for the City and Borough of Juneau, managing the risks and rewards while climbing out of a pandemic. It was a big surprise when enrollment for the Juneau School District's homeschool program went through the roof 2 years ago. Why interest remains strong, and how your family can learn more about the Homebridge program when we come back. Welcome back to Juneau Afternoon. I'm Rhonda McBride. Pre-COVID, the homeschool program in the Juneau School District was fairly small, and then came COVID, and enrollment mushroomed. And joining us now, Mark Gunkel, he's an advisory teacher with the Homebridge program, and that program also has an open house coming up next week, which we will talk about later in our program. But Mark, I think it would be very interesting to understand the trajectory of the enrollment. What were the numbers before COVID, then afterwards, and where are they now?
Great question, Rhonda. Thank you for having me. Yeah, 2 years ago, before COVID, there was about 35 students in the Homebridge program. And then the next year, the enrollment ballooned to 450 students. And so it was a mad scramble, just getting everybody everything they needed and kind of reinventing our program. And it didn't drop off as drastically as projected this year when students returned to school. We still have about 250 to 275 students right now.
Wow, but to mushroom to 450 students, I mean, that I guess is something beyond your dreams. I imagine you never in your wildest dreams ever expected that to happen?
No, it was just a mad scramble. We had at times between 30 and 40 people signing up every day, and just the process of dealing with that volume and mass emails was a learning curve for sure. So
you're back down considerably, but still you've got a lot of strong interest, 250 to 275 people. That's still pretty substantial compared to the original 35 that you started with pre-pandemic. What reasons did people give you for leaving the program? Was it that they were happy that in-person classes were more or less back in the school district?
Well, yeah, a lot of the people that enrolled were doing so because of the pandemic, and there was a bit of frustration with the distance learning, and it wasn't going well, and the roller coaster of in school and out of school. They just wanted some stability, but over the course of the year, it didn't return back to the 35 students. A lot of people kind of liked it. There were some advantages to it. Families could travel or go on staycations. If there's problems with bullying, they could avoid that. A lot of families just want more control over what their children are being taught, avoid negative peer influence. And anxiety is a big issue. There still seems to be a lot of anxiety in the school. And so a lot of kids are signing up for that reason. On the high school level, we have one student that is pursuing his passion. He's really passionate about hockey, and this allows him to go to Southern California and play in a higher level hockey league during part of the school year. Another student's fishing the black cod season, which is 4 months long. We have several students that just enjoy the flexible schedule so they can work full-time jobs at the high school level. And then just one more mention, the Alaska Advantage program allows high school students to take university classes at half price. And they can earn college credit and high school credit at the same time. And this is just a huge advantage for a lot of kids. So there's just a lot of positive reasons to stay with the program that people are becoming aware of.
So I imagine when you're going from 35, to over 400 students almost overnight, that you probably had to grow your program and make a lot of changes. What have you done in the last couple of years with the Homebridge program?
There's been, you're exactly right. We went from one halftime administrative assistant and one halftime advisory teacher to a full-time admin assistant. And last year we had four full-time advisory teachers. And so we all had a lot to learn in a short amount of time. This year, it was a developing time. We were able to get systems in place to handle the number of students. And so with our reduced numbers and the systems in place, it's really going much, much more smoothly this year.
Well, I'm trying to envision how this works. I mean, is it all homeschooling? Can someone opt to maybe take a band class or something? Can you have a mix and match scenario with the Homebridge program?
Absolutely. A lot of our students do. And that's one of the benefits of Homebridge, is that you can still be involved in the neighborhood schools and be part of Homebridge as well. So the students can take up to two classes and still receive the full allotment. An allotment is just a pool of money that we have that they're able to use for supplies and curriculum and to purchase classes online. So they can take two classes. A third class at the neighborhood school reduces their allotment by 25%. But, at the high school level and the middle school and elementary level, the SPED department still services these kids. And the high school counselors are still their counselors, and they would be associated with one of the schools. And so they would still graduate from TM or JD, and that's who their diploma would be from.
I think that probably homeschool parents are probably really learning to appreciate teachers, because it isn't easy to do what they do. And so they're discovering, they're having to stretch. And I wonder, what have you heard from people that have pulled away from homeschooling? Because I would imagine that it's not for everyone.
No, it's absolutely not for everyone. And everyone, when they first start, especially when you have multiple kids at different age groups and you're trying to manage that load and get them what they need, it can be stressful, just like a teaching in a classroom. And it's it can become pretty anxious. And one of the things, you know, they're just so scared. Am I screwing my kid up? You hear that a lot, and you have to reassure them and that they're not screwing their kid up, and the time they're putting in is good. But you know, a lot of the kids' parents did have their kids here because there wasn't in-person learning. So as those classrooms opened up, they naturally moved back to the classrooms. Not all of them, but some of them.
I have heard people say that the impacts of the pandemic will linger, you know, long after it finally fades in education, that we will see fallout from that for years to come. Are the homeschooled children faring any better? Is there any way to tell yet, or is it too soon?
Well, it's hard to look at this very last year or the 2 years before and compare it to public school. The distance learning was a new thing for public schools, and those teachers are great, and they did a great job in short notice in the time that they had to supply these classes distance. It wasn't the best situation, though, by any means. You know, nationally, homeschoolers have always performed pretty well. You know, there's been over 9 million people that have been homeschooled at one point or another in the United States. But the graduation rates between homeschoolers and public school for college is higher. 67% is the average for college graduation for homeschools, while 59% of public school students graduate from college. So it's always had a pretty strong track record academically.
But it's interesting that prior to COVID that Juneau as a community didn't seem to have as much interest in homeschooling as other regions of the state.
You know, that is interesting, and it's maybe there's more light on it because Homebridge is a Juneau school district program, but all of the providers in the Juneau area have seen similar increases in their enrollment. Yukon Koyukuk School District has Raven, and Galena School District has IDEA in the area offering homeschooling, but they've always had a considerable number of kids even before the pandemic here.
So before we run out of time, you've got an open house next Tuesday. How is that going to work, and how can parents prepare, families prepare?
Right, yeah, our office is in the Mary Drake Building right between Juneau Douglas High School and Harborview Elementary School. It's just right off the left end of the turf field, the main doors for the Mary Drake Building. And we've got a couple classrooms and a couple different, and a room with our office in it. We just want to open it up to get parents, existing parents in. And we've got a little survey and some feedback that we want from existing parents. But mostly we just want in-person feedback, and we want to meet people that might be considering homeschooling. We want to show them our space and show them all the activities that we have for the kids, and answer any questions that they might have. It's no scheduled program, no scheduled activities. It's just going to be a pretty relaxed time for questions and answers.
So if parents are pondering this, thinking about making this move, what cautions could you give them to decide whether or not they might be a good fit for this? Or maybe the chance to talk to people will give them that opportunity to gauge that themselves. I don't know.
Yeah, you know, one is, do they have time? Do they have the time available to put into their kids? And it just depends on the age of the kids. The high schoolers, a lot of times, are taking classes provided online, self-paced classes, and they don't need a lot of parent input. But at that elementary and middle school age, a parent input is important. But, you know, for parents that it's right for, you know, we're kind of charged with the task of raising our kids. And when that extends to education, it is it can be an unbelievably rewarding experience. And I'm speaking from experience. We have three kids. One's an 11th grader now. And another advantage of homeschooling, and she's part of the Homebridge program, is that you can work ahead and graduate early. You're not held to the class schedule. The other two are grown adults. My son is actually a teacher at Thunder Mountain High School. He's the real Mr. Gunkel. And
the real Mr. Gunkel. There are twin Gunkels, I guess.
And my daughter is a nurse here and a mother living in Juneau as well. But that open house, I didn't mention, it is Tuesday, February 1st, this coming Tuesday from 4 to 6 p.m. at the Mary Drake Building.
So just in closing here, what do you hope will happen in the coming years with homeschooling? You think you definitely think that it is going to remain in the school district as an option for people? It's not going to go away when COVID disappears?
No, homeschooling has been growing nationwide even before COVID. It's all over the state, all over the nation. And I just hope that we can develop our program so it'll meet the needs of parents who are going to homeschool anyway, so they'll choose us and stay in the district.
So did you enjoy being able to spend some more time with your kids at home? I mean, did you and your wife actually teach your children?
We did, you know, and it fell on my wife, who happens to be an advisory teacher for Raven, by the way. It was just absolutely rewarding. I worked in different parts of the country and the family was able to follow along, and 4 months here and 2 months there. And it was just fantastic.
But see, you're already in education, so you might have a leg up on someone who has not had that kind of experience. But boy, it's really interesting to learn about. I hope that your open house next Tuesday night goes well. And once again, you want to give the times and the place.
You bet. Open house at the Mary Drake Building. There'll be signs out front so you know where to go. It's just off the left end of the turf field beside Juno Douglas High School. Tuesday from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. Come on by. We'll have some cookies and answer all your questions.
Cookies and questions. There you go. All right. Thank you, Mark Gunkel, who is an advisory teacher with the Juno School District's homeschool program, Homebridge. Thanks for being here with us to tell us about your open house. We hope you have a good turnout.
Great. Thank you so much.
Support for Juno Afternoon is provided by Hanson Gress, Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, and Klingit and Haida Social Enterprises. For more information, visit ktoo.org/JunoAfternoon.
And that will do it for Juno Afternoon on this Friday. Broadcast from Klingit and Haida on KTOO 104.3 FM. Juno Afternoon airs live at 3 o'clock Tuesday through Friday, repeats at 7. And you can also listen online at ktoo.org. Until next time, thanks for joining the conversation. From all of us at KTOO, Galuxchi.